Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 18th day of February, 2023. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Every day we hear that we are more divided in the United States of America than ever before. We hear it. We hear it everywhere. We hear it all the time, but it's not even close to true. We have experienced virtually all of our current problems before and have managed to get through such turbulent and fraught periods as a country, as a people. We are more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. And more than that, we're not nearly as divided as it looks. You know, you have an election, it turns out about 50-50, and everybody says that means the country is divided. Well, divided between two candidates, perhaps, between two parties, perhaps, but it looks this way, it sounds this way, because the noisy crazies on both extremes get a wildly disproportionate share of attention in both legacy media and social media. And to talk about why that's happening and why and what we can do to better our lives in light of the apparent divisions, it's my pleasure to welcome the author of Presidential Leadership in Crisis, Defining Moments of the Modern Presidents from Franklin Roosevelt to Donald Trump, to our microphones, Kenneth Walsh. Welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Nice to be back, Steve. Always glad to be with you.
Are we more divided than ever before?
Well, I think it looks that way to some extent, and I agree with what you said in the opener, that there's a lot of noise about how divided we are, and the people at the extremes are much more adept at getting attention, and we do have something called an outrage industry now, where people are using creation of outrage and anger and resentment and grievance to divide the country, and also to make money through cable news and social media and various other things. But I think if you look at the history, our country has been regularly divided throughout our history. I mean, in the very beginning, the Revolutionary War, you know, there were no surveys then, but the feeling was that it was very difficult to get the whole country behind what became the country behind the war, because there were a lot of people called Tories who were supportive of the British. So right from the beginning, we were divided, even on whether to be to break from the United Kingdom. The most vivid example, I think, of our division, of course, was the run up to the Civil War and the Civil War. We were literally at each other's throats over slavery and the Union and so on. So that's probably the best example, certainly the best example of the ultimate in divisions, because we fought a war over our divisions.
Kenneth T. Walsh is an adjunct professor of communication at American University in Washington, D.C., and an award-winning journalist who serves as contributing White House analyst for U.S. News and World Report, and is the author of about 10 books. He's covered the White House for U.S. News and World Reports since 1986, so that includes the presidencies of every president since Ronald Reagan, including Joe Biden. We'll spend a few minutes on the outlook for the 2024 presidential race in a few minutes, but first, I want to explore this division polarization question a little bit further. When we go back and we look at news online, it looks really bad. But when I look at the real world, the people that I know in every walk of life, people who I talk with in business, people who I meet socially, people who I meet through charity events where I'm talking to different people who are not living in the same world that I am, but who are themselves have. What I find is that people are trying to live their lives. They want to love their loved ones. They want to raise their children. They want to have fun. They want to feel safe. They want to be able someday to have some financial ease or freedom. They want all of the same things. They want good health. They want clean water. All of these things that people agree on. And when I then ask them about politics, they roll their eyes and they say, I don't feel like I belong in any party or belong or agree with anyone. There's a sense of disconnect. And yet when you look at media and social media, it looks like there are very clear battle lines that have been drawn. What do you see?
Well, I think you're right about that in general. I have a little bit different perception of it, though. I think on the extremes, the right and the left, the Make America Great Again hardliners, Trump supporters, and then people on the left in sort of on their extreme wing of the Democratic Party and the liberal side of things, I think those people are really riled up and they're really angry and resentful. And you look at polls, or just a poll out in the last few days, again, reinforcing this idea that most people at these extremes, they don't want to associate with the people on the other side at the equivalent point in the other side of the extreme. They don't want to live next to them. They don't want to talk to them. That's pretty divided. But the people in the middle, and, you know, there's a lot of survey indicating that when people vote, the middle shrinks because people vote Democrat or Republican, and there's fewer swing voters in the country these days. But basically, when it comes to being sort of angry with your neighbor over politics, I think that is a relatively small number of people. But as you said, Steve, it looks outsized in I think in large part because of the media and the social media and the extreme cable networks, which if you look at Fox versus MSNBC, for instance, you see an entirely different version of reality. And I use the term reality loosely, really, for both sides. But I think most people, they do long for the idea that we're not as angry with each other and as dismissive of each other. But for the extremes, those people are so aggrieved, whether it's justified or not, that I don't see that going away for a very long time.
I think that's probably right. And the question is how many people actually agree with them or agree in part or even not at all. When we have had polarizing political battles over race and discrimination and civil rights and voting rights, if you look at the I think it was Barack Obama who said that the arc of history bends toward justice, that's correct. We've gone from a country where slavery was legal and entrenched, it's gone, to a place where women were not allowed to vote, that's gone, to a place where Jim Crow segregation was legal and supported by legislatures and courts, that's gone. And You come to a place where it's not clear to me that there's much more to do in law. I can't see the things, maybe on the margins, on the fringes, but there are no large frontiers of legislation when it comes to issues over race and discrimination and civil rights and voting rights and so forth. And Jim Crow type segregation. And yet there's a sense that more needs to be done. I don't know that it's going to happen through law and government as much as it will through social advocacy.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, I also, in thinking about this, and this is, we talk about this in Washington all the time, how polarized are we? We do it in newsrooms. We do it in political meetings. It happens in strategy meetings for candidates. It happens all the time. Not that we find any solutions, but basically there's a lot of people thinking about this. But one thing that sort of softens my sense about how divided we are about race is how much we idolize our sports heroes who are African American. And to me, that's a big deal. And, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we didn't have any black athletes in the major leagues in baseball and football. That's a relatively new phenomenon. That's been well documented with Jackie Robinson and other players. But today, you know, the two heroes of the Super Bowl were two black quarterbacks. And they're very popular in their communities. I mean, nobody brings up the race issue hardly at all when they talk about these guys, although it did come up with this Super Bowl because it was the first time there were two black quarterbacks. And they were very terrific quarterbacks, too. So, I mean, to me, that's a social indicator that in their daily lives, that the notion of the taboos of race have faded so dramatically, even for in my lifetime, I can see it. And I think that's a very good thing. And I don't think we congratulate ourselves on that as much as we should.
It is a very good thing, and it needs to be recognized in the fact that it was pointed out, brought up, and highlighted that we had two black quarterbacks in the Super Bowl. It makes perfect sense. It's something to be celebrated. You would think that would carry over further into political statements that are made by politicians. Every time we see politicians, I listened this week to Adam Schiff, who is a Democratic congressman from California, who has now announced that he's going to run for the United States Senate to replace Dianne Feinstein, who is not running for re-election. And I also listened to an interview with Nikki Haley, former governor of South Carolina, former United Nations ambassador from the United States, who is running for president. And they were both talking about necessary legislation. Now, it makes sense that the senator would be calling for legislation. It makes sense that a president would be calling for legislation. But it looks to me like we're asking more of our politicians than they can deliver. We're asking more of government than government can deliver. And the emphasis has to be instead to help lift people out of persistent poverty, to help rehabilitate people who have been in prison, to help educate people as to with something that's a useful skill, something they can support their families with. And it doesn't seem like government, it seems like government at best is a blunt instrument for these things. And yet the coverage that we get makes it sound like the government might be the solution to these things, where I think it's pretty evident it's not.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, you know, for a while, you know, when Biden was running for president, of course, in defining what the Democratic Party stands for in his mind, he was never a real let government do everything kind of politician. He moved in that direction in his first months in office. I think he was, to some extent, captured by the left in some ways. But he's moved back away from that again now. And I think now that he's gotten the infrastructure bill through, and that was a real big government spending program that I'm not criticizing. I think that's what people wanted, but and various other things. But I think I think he's acknowledged now that even though he wants to keep trying to get bipartisan support for different proposals, including government activism, it's going to be almost impossible to do that now for the foreseeable future. So I think that, remember when Bill Clinton said the era of big government is over? Well, yes. That changed rather rapidly, particularly when President Obama was in office, because we needed the government to get us out of the terrible financial meltdown we were going through. And that started with President Bush, who was a Republican, Bush the son. So anyway, that's a long way of saying basically that I think that there's a lot of skepticism, even cynicism about government. And when you talk to Democrats and people in the White House, a lot of times they come back to this idea that what Biden wants to do is restore trust in government and trust in our leaders, and really in our elites even. But I think it's so much of an uphill struggle, and I don't think he's going to be very successful in doing that. But that skepticism of government has been part of America from the beginning. That's what we were sort of built on. And so I do think that by and large, as far as the use of government, government spending, government programs, Americans remain really center right on that sort of thing. Skeptical about it, but willing to do it in difficult times.
Because I agree with you that most Americans tend to be center right on economic issues, center left on social issues, I question whether the big spending bills now by President Biden in the last couple of years were as popular as it would seem. It seems to me when I talk to Democrats, not certainly Republicans think this, but when I talk to Democrats, they are concerned with the government spending on two levels. One is, how are we going to pay for that? That is going to result in higher taxes for everyone who pays taxes. And how are we going to get out of that debt? And what happens if interest rates really do rise and stay high? How will that limit government's ability to respond to the next crisis?
Right.
And how efficient is that? What difference does it actually make in one's life? Those are the questions I hear from people who have voted Democrat consistently and will probably vote Democrat in the future. They're worried about that. And you said also that we needed President Obama to follow up on the policy from President George W. Bush as the economic crisis and collapse of late 2008 came to the forefront. And I question that as well. It seems to me that you needed an immediate shock, and that part I agree with. But a good deal of the spending, the tremendous, staggering debt that's unprecedented, a larger piece of the gross domestic product than it's ever been, that seems to me to be fraught. I think that is something that is encountering political resistance from the center of the country.
It was, but having covered all that stuff day to day, that financial meltdown, what Obama did about it, to this day, many liberals in the party think he didn't go far enough, not only in crippling Wall Street and the big investment houses, but punishing them, having people thrown in jail for that financial meltdown. You still get that on the left of the party. And a lot of people, you know, this is part of what I wrote about in my book about presidential leadership in crisis. The remnants of that period, I think Obama comes off well, basically, from that period. But in addition to the people who were concerned that he did spend more money, there's still a lot of people in his own party that felt that this was, in the words of the former White House advisor, Rahm Emanuel, you don't let a good crisis go to waste. And he did not move enough to seize the opportunity to cripple Wall Street and the big banks and investment houses when he had the opportunity. So there is still that argument, I think, what that means for the current context of things is that in the Democratic Party, when we get into these nominating battles, there is going to be a strong left in the party, left wing, that is going to go back to more government and more spending. And I don't know who's going to carry the banner against that other than Biden, if he does pursue the campaign, as it looks like he's doing. But that is going to be a big fault line in the Democratic Party, I think, coming up.
We have two separate issues, crippling Wall Street, as you phrased it, versus spending. So on crippling Wall Street, I don't want to cripple Wall Street. Wall Street is necessary for capital raising. It's accounted for a high standard of living and tremendous progress, the ability to invest, and the ability mainly for individuals, one human being, to buy a share of stock in a company and have a piece of that company, and to be able to do that to the extent of their ability to invest. So I don't want to cripple Wall Street. I definitely want to rein in the large companies. I want to regulate them. I want to restrict them. But the challenge is that when you create overall restrictions, it restricts, you know, the local barber shop and the local muffler shop, and then they cut back on employment, and they cut back on expansion, and they cut back on capital investment. So I've got a problem with the idea of crippling Wall Street. The idea I'd rather have is, if there are criminal behaviors, let's pass laws against them. The reason we didn't throw people in jail from the 2008 crisis is because we don't throw people in jail. We find what crime, what law they violated, what criminal statute they violated. We indict them, we try them, and if found guilty, then we put them in prison. But the reason nobody went to prison in the 2008 crisis is because there were no laws against what was happening. Those people were taking advantage of the laws and using the laws to legally do things that should have been illegal. So that's one place where I could see a call for legislation is in insider trading, in people who are in Congress who are investing in the companies over which they are holding hearings and have inside information, over people who, without any recourse to themselves, make tremendous amounts of money selling bad ideas, bad investments, bad loans to the government, who has a revolving door with the lobbyists and the people in the companies who allow these things to happen legally. That seems to be where the problem has to be tackled. But that's completely separate from whether the government should spend more money doing things that are inefficient.
Yeah, but I think just our discussion here, I mean, I think, you know, we understand each other, and I think we mostly agree on these things. But basically, you know, try explaining this to a working class white guy, you know, working in a muffler shop in Cincinnati. I mean, it's very difficult, you know, and that's why I think a lot of these folks feel so aggrieved, because they don't feel like anybody is speaking to them and speaking their language. And maybe they're not following it as carefully as they need to. But then that gets back to what information they're getting, and if they're being the outrage industry and all the rest of it. But it's very difficult to make the kind of discussion you and I are having and make it persuasive to the working class, which is really, I think, the source of a lot of the resentment and anger in the country. And it's just that I think those folks feel, well, nobody's really speaking to me, and they're not taking care of me. And by the way, I think this whole issue with this spill in Ohio is going to aggravate this whole thing, because, you know, this is getting huge attention, and the people in that community really want government help, and you're getting this contrarian storyline that Biden is not giving them help. That's really not fair to Biden, for rather complicated reasons.
Explain those complicated reasons, because what I just saw last night was a story that Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, who is a Republican, yes, who was just reelected, yes, with something like a 20% margin, so very popular in Ohio, which is not a red state. It's more mixed. And he's asked the White House for help with this spill, and they said no. Why did the president say no? I'm asking because I really haven't been able to study this yet.
Yeah. Well, I think that a lot of this is being garbled, but the way I understand it, garbled by the media. But basically, I think what happened is Governor DeWine did not ask for help initially. What he was trying to do is maneuver the situation so the railroad would pay for the cleanup and would be held responsible, not the government, either the state government or the federal government. So that explains the delay. He didn't ask for help initially. He took a lot of flack for that. And I don't think he explained himself very well. But my understanding is that what he's trying to do is to get into the position where the government doesn't pay for help at all. It's the railroad who gets the blame. And so he's trying to save people money, basically. And Biden was trying to go along with that. Now, they're both taking a lot of flack at this point, and they're trying to argue now that, well, the federal government is sending in help. The state government is sending help. They're sending in scientists to find out what we can do to clean things up and how bad things are. But it's very difficult to make that case when it appears that they're turning down the kind of aid that the country has come to expect after, like, natural disasters like hurricanes and tornadoes and storms and such. But the Governor DeWine was trying to actually use conservative principles here in getting the company to pay for the problem not the government. And Biden was trying to go along with it. That's what I thought. That's my understanding of why there's been this big delay and this big sense that why isn't the government helping?
See, it looks like it should be simple, and I'm sure that it shouldn't be, but it seems like it should be, that what should happen is two steps. The first is the federal government through FEMA, F-E-M-A, the Federal Emergency Management Administration, should come in with emergency power and emergency help. So that's going to be water and portable lavatories and cleanup and containment and food and portable generators, whatever is necessary to instantly come in and help people to survive and to get back to try to have a reentry point into their normal lives. And that's going to be money spent by the government that's been allocated already. It's there, and we have that system and that structure set up. That's part one. Part two would be to have the state attorney general of Ohio and the state's attorney of Ohio to bring appropriate lawsuits against the attorney general of the United States to bring appropriate civil actions against the railroads to get the money back. Whatever we spent should be reimbursed. It's the same thing as when my house catches fire. If the fire department comes out, it comes out at the expense of the county, and they put out the fire to protect what's left of my house and to protect the neighbor's house from going up in flames. And then if there's civil responsibility, if I, for example, set the fire, or if there's an appliance that caused the fire and it's the fault, well, then there are lawsuits that cause the money to come back, and there's a way for the fire department to recover some of that money or all of that money. Why isn't this that straightforward?
I think that is those are very, very well taken points. And I'm not trying to defend DeWine or Biden, by the way. I'm just trying to explain my understanding of what they did. I think that there's this common problem that presidents have after a disaster. When does the president go in and empathize with people? And well, some presidents don't do it, and they say, I don't want to interfere with the response of the government and so on. Other presidents say no. That's a problem they always have. But in this case, they're not even initially, they weren't even letting the aid come in from FEMA, as you say. And I found that extremely curious, if not bizarre. But I think it all ties into this notion that DeWine was trying to develop sort of an ideologically compatible conservative way of handling this. And he came up with this idea of not asking for federal help immediately. I mean, that would have been the easy thing to do. And that would have been the thing that the most people would have wanted in that community and in his state. And I think the country would understand that. But he didn't do that. Now he's doing it. Now he's trying to ask for help. But it's pretty late in the game now. You know, I mean, they should have had, as you say, the water and temporary residences and all that sort of thing in there within hours, really. That's supposed to be what FEMA does.
9 years ago is the first time, Ken Walsh, that you were a guest on this show, back in 2014, and you've been very gracious in coming back again and again for many different things. You've written a bunch of books, and all of them excellent. We've discussed many of them on many shows here on TalkRadio1.com. The your most recent book, Presidential Leadership in Crisis, Defining Moments of the Modern Presidents from Franklin Roosevelt to Donald Trump. We've talked about that in multiple separate shows, but I want to come back to it here because you outline five characteristics, five qualities that are most important. And you say in presidential crisis management, and I've taken this truly as an icon of things that I believe in for anyone's personal leadership in personal crisis. And these five elements are: number one, taking action; two, adapting to changing circumstances; three, balancing principle with what works; 4, persevering, and then 5, an instinct for achieving success, the most, which you describe as being the most important quality of all. And when I look at that in light of, let's just take this railroad crisis in Ohio and Pennsylvania near the border there, and this horrible environmental catastrophe, this human tragedy, this economic disaster, not just the disaster itself and everything led to it, but everything that follows from it. How do you, when you look at presidential leadership from Joe Biden and gubernatorial leadership from Mike DeWine, from this early stage, and I know this is very early to tell, how would you go through those characteristics and describe how well or how poorly each of them is doing?
Yeah, well, I think on the taking action part, I think they both sort of flunked that test so far. Something that Americans think of themselves and they think of their leaders as action-oriented, to do something when something goes wrong. Sometimes that's wrong-headed in a situation. Maybe a pause must be taken. But I think in this case of the Ohio situation, I think they really both should be faulted for not taking action, even if it was not something that was going to be lasting, but just to get some help to those people, to know that they weren't being abandoned by their government. I think a lot of the people felt that way. I think they are adapting to changing
circumstances. Well, let's stick with taking action just for a second. When you look at this, and I agree with you completely, Ken, I think they both didn't act. Why? This isn't the first time a train has crashed. We've had plane crashes. We've had hurricanes and tornadoes and fires and all sorts of things. This isn't new. Why would both of them, a Republican and a Democrat, a federal official and a state official, both in the executive branch, why would both of them miss this?
I think we're all trying to sort of grasp what happened here, and it is hard to understand. I think in sort of the sequencing here, the way the disaster requests work, the governor has to ask for it first, and DeWine did not ask for it. So he waited a long time before he asked for it. So I think you have to go back to that state issue. Remember, during Katrina, there was some to-ing and fro-ing whether the governor of Louisiana, who was a Democrat at the time, asked for help quickly enough from President Bush, the son. And of course, you remember all those terrible images of people desperate for help, and the help was not coming. And Bush was saying, well, the governor has to ask me for it. I can't just send troops in there. The governor has to request it. Now, the governor did in the end do that, but they both took a lot of hits for that. It sounds like a similar thing here, that perhaps Governor DeWine just did not move quickly enough in asking for help. And because it has to be triggered by a governor, that's the way it's worked for a long, long time. And so I think that's one.
Well,
part
okay.
Of it.
So taking that, you and I both remember when Bill Clinton, a Democrat, and Ronald Reagan, a Republican, both reached out in the names of crises, and I can't remember which crisis, but they both reached out and said, the White House is standing ready. We're asking the governor to tell us what help they need so we can send it. It would seem like the White House comms department would have said something like that. Is this just a political confusion? Are they distracted? How does that, from your understanding from covering the White House continuously since 1986, how do things like that go wrong in the White House, where the president doesn't come out and say, even if he can't send help without being asked because of the federal separation and restrictions, what is it that causes the White House comms department to miss the opportunity to say, this is a terrible human tragedy, and the White House, the federal government, is standing ready, willing, and able to act as soon as Governor DeWine tells us he wants us in, we're there. Why wouldn't they have done that?
Well, I think one thing that jumps out at me, and this will require more reporting from me and from other reporters, is the chief of staff, Ron Klain, was not there. He left. They have a gap, a huge gap. In recent weeks, there was no White House chief of staff who had taken control. Ron Klain left the job, and he was very popular with President Biden. He was a very good administrator. He left. You know, it wasn't a surprise he left. Jeffrey Zients is coming in, and he's a business guy. For all indications, he'll be fine as chief of staff. But there has been an interregnum here. There's been a period where nobody was really in charge, as they should have been. Maybe that explains it. You know, you got to figure that it had to have something to do with it, because this was exactly the period where one chief of staff left and the other one was taking over. And so maybe that's the problem. Maybe
sometimes the simplest explanation might be the answer.
Yeah, that could be.
So back to the apparent division in the country for a moment. I vividly remember in 1968, I was 15 years old, and I remember saying to my dad that it looks like the world is coming to an end. We had race riots in 8 major cities. We had assassinations that were going on. Martin Luther King and Senator Bobby Kennedy, and earlier Malcolm X, and it just looked like things were falling apart. We had the Vietnam War and all of the protests. We had this cultural and social collapse where people were saying, tune in, turn on, drop out, and talking about a generation gap and a set of values that young people had, young people who are now old people, the baby boom generation, who were saying that we will not work 50 years for a gold watch, and saying no to the institutions of all, of government, of marriage, of any sort of religious affiliation. We saw tremendous rebellion in all this. And I remember it looked like the world was coming to an end. And of course, you know, that's now more than 50 years ago, and things changed and healed. Is it just that right now in 2023, we can't see the perspective that everything's going to be okay? Are you confident things are likely to be okay? Or do you take the view of some, I don't, but do you take the view of some that the best days of America are behind it, and that what comes next has to be a tearing down of what's left?
No, I don't feel that way at all. I tend to be more optimistic about things. I think I lived through 1968 as well. I've written extensively about this. We've talked about it on your show. I'm a bit older than you, but I do remember that very, very vividly. I was in college at the time. And, you know, it started out with the Tet Offensive, which gave the lie to all this claim by President Johnson at the time and General Westmoreland, who's in charge of the Vietnam War, that we were winning. The Tet Offensive was over the Tet holiday, which was a holiday in Vietnam. The communist forces of North Vietnam and their allies, the Viet Cong, attacked all over the country. And it was right under our noses and right under our allies' noses, the South Vietnamese. And they took over the embassy in Saigon. They took over much of the country. And so even though in the end, the United States and our allies won the battles and drove them off at tremendous cost to the enemy, it showed that this war was far from over. We're going to take many more casualties. The Vietnamese would take many more casualties, cost a lot more money, and it'll still be a stalemate. And that was how we started the year off, giving the lie to our leaders that they weren't being straight with us. And it just got worse and worse after that. And remember, the other thing we haven't mentioned yet, we had riots at the Democratic Convention that year. It seemed like we were having a nervous breakdown. People really were polarized, tremendously polarized. And then the other important point, which is very relevant today, despite all the things that you mentioned, Steve, the generation gap and the culture gap and the anti-establishment feelings and one thing after another, the country ended up with two major party nominees who were the most establishment and least inspirational of any of the candidates, Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. We're headed now to doing the same thing with Biden and Trump. Very unpopular figures in many ways, and really representing what the country says it doesn't want. Old white guys running for office. And that seems to be the way we're headed. So it's not good for optimism about government where we are now politically. But I do think the country has a way of being more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. And I think this too shall pass. We'll sort of step back and figure, you know, we're not going to jump off the cliff. We're not going to hate each other anymore. Let's try to have more reason about things and more common sense and more sort of living up to the values of neighborliness and e pluribus unum that we supposedly believe in. I think that'll come back. I don't know when. Maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I just feel like the Americans are pretty pragmatic people. And if we think we're going too far in this divisiveness, I think we're going to back off from it.
I believe with all my heart that that is correct. The American people, in vast majority, not 5%, I'm going to say more like 80%, are not ideologues on either side. They are not dedicated to a political philosophy on either side. 80%, I believe, of the people in the country are dedicated to practicality and morality, who are striving for high ideals and trying their best every day to live their lives to the best of their ability, and that there is very little tolerance in that center 80% for nuts and radicals and extremists. And I look at the 22 election as being an example of this. I think the Democrats have interpreted the message of 2022 to say that where the Republicans had a very underwhelming performance, a disappointment for the Republicans, the Democrats in leadership, not most of the individuals, but in leadership, have interpreted the 22 outcome as being a support for spending, a support for the government policies of the Democratic Senate, the Democratic House, and the Democratic White House, where I think the real answer was that it was a rejection of the Republican nomination of people like Dan Bolduc and Mehmet Oz and Doug Mastriano and Kerry Lake and others, all of whom lost at a time when moderate Republicans like Mike DeWine in Ohio or Brian Kemp in Georgia, or for that matter, you can disagree with many of his positions, but an effective governor who's effectively governing Florida, Ron DeSantis, while they got reelected by substantial margins over opponents, over Democratic opponents, I think that the Democrats have misinterpreted the 22 results, which will lead to problems in 24. I think the Republicans have failed to learn the lesson of 22, which is that when you have extreme candidates who are not qualified to lead and make and take extreme positions, that they are not going to be elected. It seems to me both parties are currently missing the 2024 vote as a result of their misinterpretation of the outcome of 2022.
I think that's a very good summary. I think that we're going to see this reflected in the campaign as it's unfolding too. You get somebody like Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina, former UN ambassador under President Trump, has been sort of back and forth on this. She likes Trump. She hates Trump. She loves Trump. She doesn't have any use for Trump. Now she's trying to find this middle ground that she has the Trump policies. This seems to be what the Republicans, the more veteran Republicans who won before, feel that we have the Trump policies, but without the insult and outrage culture that he has reinforced. You know, one thing that she's done, and this gets to this age issue, which is also a dig at not only Biden, but at Trump, that everybody over the age of 75 needs to take a cognitive test in order to be president.
Of course, bearing in mind that Donald Trump will be over 75 yes, at the time of the next
exactly,
election.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. Yeah, he's 76 years old right now. So he would fall under her sort of framework to be cognitively tested. Now, I'm very skeptical about this cognitive testing. And I'm not wild about this whole idea of standardized testing anyway, but basically it's shorthand for we've got to pay more attention to the age and cognitive abilities of the candidates. And in that way, she is sort of moving away from the Trump model for what the Republicans want in candidates. These extreme people, many of whom, as you said, lost. So you're seeing that happen. And DeSantis is another good example. Very tough policies, very conservative policies, maybe too conservative for the country, but basically very popular in Florida. And that's what, in the end, you got to win the elections to put the policies forward. And DeSantis has a tremendous advantage in this developing field because he has won re-election very strongly. So that's a big advantage for him.
I know that we are light years away from the 2024 election. Everything that looks like it might be something now might be nothing later. I know that in the 2016 cycle Scott Walker, thank you, was going to be the next president of the United States. He had tremendous support and so forth, and there were flashes of that, and of course he has not been politically heard from since. And many other people came up and went down in that race and had a moment of, okay, that's the candidate, including Michael Bloomberg. And so it's hard to tell right now, but at the moment, if you look at the polls, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump appear to be the only two people with a statistical path to victory. And of course, that could change. Who else looks to you like they might have a statistical path to victory?
Well, I think you've gotten for the Republicans, you've gotten the two. So far and away, it's sort of Trump and DeSantis and everybody else. That seems to be the way it's shaping up. But there's always, you know, I've wedded to the idea of sort of paths to the nomination. Who has the path? Which I think you use that same phrasing. And I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, Trump has his own make America great again, put me back into office, the tough guy, conservative path. DeSantis is the effective governor. You know, the conservative policies have been implemented and his state has ratified them. Then you have other possibilities. But I think basically, you know, John Bolton, the former national security advisor, is running for president. I don't think he's going to get anywhere, but he's going to try to take a national security pathway. And as I say, I don't think that's going to work.
Well, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and Nikki Haley, yes, all will have an edge in talking about foreign policy, and yet foreign policy does not seem, astonishingly to me, to be of interest to most Americans until it's immediate, until there's a crisis right now. And they very rarely, since the Cold War ended, it's very rarely been an issue in presidential politics that matters.
Right. Well, then you have the more moderate or sort of centrist, pragmatic governing types like former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, former Governor Asa Hutchinson, who's talking about running. So there's that other.
And let's add to that New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu.
Yes.
Could even talk about South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. And it's a little early, but Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia, Governor Glenn Youngkin of Virginia, and of course, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie.
Right. Yes. So that's another path. More traditional conservatives. But I think basically and we also have sort of the path of the insurgent, somebody who comes out of nowhere. We had that many, many times in our history, and that person tends to flame out, but sometimes they don't. And, you know, that's happened in, you know, remember Ross Perot became, he was an independent.
Got 20% you know, of the vote in 1980, yes, in 1992.
Exactly. And that's another thing to be aware of as people look at this whole situation. There's a lot of Republicans who are concerned that if Trump does not win the nomination, he'll run as a third party candidate and throw everything, just take the party down with him.
Or if he even doesn't run as a third party candidate, Ken, he could simply stand on the side of the road and throw rocks, yes, saying, "There's no one here to vote for. Stay home." And I think a lot of people would stay home.
I think you're right. And so that's the Republican side. The Democratic side, you know, if Biden does run, I think you probably get a couple of candidates who would end up being marginal candidates. I don't think the real heavyweights would get in and challenge Biden for the nomination. But if he does not run, I mean, that field is going to get really large, really fast. And, you know, the last time it was actually 2016, I'm thinking more of, where remember they had to have two debates for the Democrats because there were so many candidates they couldn't fit them on one stage.
Right, right.
You know, so I think you're going to have that again, and maybe even more. Then you got, you know, people like Governor Newsom from California, and you've got
Jared Polis from Colorado, Governor Kathy Hochul from New York,
yes,
Governor J.B. Pritzker from Illinois.
Yeah, it goes on forever. So, but that, you know, I don't know if the Democrats want that, but that would open up the whole new generation. That would be the talk of that campaign, a new generation yearning to take leadership and poised to take leadership for both parties. And
neither one of us mentioned Vice President Kamala Harris. Does she have a constituency?
Well, Kamala Harris has, I think, a lot of Democrats, and I talk to these political consultants and strategists all the time in both parties, and there's been a tremendous amount of disappointment in her. And you're in California, so I'm sure you follow this as well, she just has not proven to have the political savvy that people thought she would. Now, maybe that's unfair to her. Maybe she's been given some of the toughest portfolios. You know, the border is one of them, where the administration takes tremendous criticism. But,
well, that's the problem. If she's given the portfolio of the border, if she could make any progress, I'd give her tremendous credit. The question is, yes, what has she done with that portfolio, if anything?
Not a lot. I mean, she a lot of it is that the administration has been sort of struggling to figure out how they want to handle this border situation. They have all kinds of different constituency problems here. Go one way, you alienate one constituency, go another way, you alienate a still different one. They don't want to admit that Trump was right, really, in any way on the border. And so there's that. But it looks back on it as the idea of be careful what you wish for, because she got a very big job. And for a lot of reasons, some of which not her fault, it's become intractable for this White House. Now, maybe they can fix it. But so far, it's, you know, if you look into that policy, it always comes back to the idea she's supposed to be in charge of it. And so it's a very difficult problem for her to handle. And vice presidents are always in this position where, you know, the boss is the president and the vice president has to go along with the program. And that's what she's trying to do. So she's walking a very fine line here and has not set herself apart really in anything, I don't think, so far.
As you often do, Ken, something you just said just triggered a thought I haven't had before, and that is on the border, that Donald Trump, from the time he came down the escalator and was talking about the border, has created a set of conditions by explaining that the border is a major problem, that immigration is a major problem that hasn't been solved, he's created a toxic zone for the Democrats because, as you said, how can they come out and say that the border is a real problem? How can the White House currently come out and say the border is a real problem and acknowledge it and begin to challenge it without at least at some level acknowledging or proving up that Donald Trump was correct about some of the things he said about the border? You know, you're faced with this. I find myself saying this to Democrats: just because President Trump said it doesn't mean it's not true. It's not that he's wrong every single time about everything. There are many things to object about him about, but he said the border is a problem. Isn't the border a problem? And Democrats are in a position where it's very hard for them politically at the top to come out and say, yes, we have a border problem and we must address it.
Yeah, well, I think that's correct. And I think that I think one of the problems they're having at the White House in trying to sort all this out is that if they admit that Trump is this is probably the best example of this, by the way, where if they admit Trump is right on part of a policy or an issue, then how much do people conflate that with all the other things he said about it? And then how much does the White House have to defend that part of Trump? For instance, on immigration and the border, look at all the horrible things that Trump said about immigrants, about people coming across the border. They're sending us their worst people, their murderers, their, one thing after another, criticizing, African countries, just horrible things he was saying. And so way far from the whole idea that we're a nation of immigrants. He's put himself in a whole different world there. So if Biden starts to support pieces of the Trump policy, then you're open to this whole notion of, maybe he's moving toward the rest of Trump's policy. And I think they're very, very worried about that. That goes to a lot of their Democratic core constituencies who would really not forgive them if they seem to be siding with Trump on this very, very sensitive issue of immigration and bringing people of color into the nation and how you treat immigrants and welcome them or whatever. I think this is a very, very difficult issue for Biden, and he hasn't found an answer to it yet.
You covered the White House of Barack Obama, as you have covered every White House since 1986. And one of the potential Democratic candidates that we haven't talked about is Michelle Obama, former First Lady of the United States, and she has consistently said that she didn't even want Barack Obama to be president, let alone her to be president. She has consistently said that she will not do it, and yet she's out with a new book. She's making a lot of public appearances. She's making a lot of statements that could be regarded as the beginnings of policy foundations, and I know that a lot of Democrats would be very pleased if she would run. I also think that if she did decide to run, that it would, for example, even against a sitting Joe Biden, but if Joe Biden were to falter or drop out of the race or not enter the race, and it looks like he's going to enter the race and run, and I don't see any reason he would veer off of that course. He's wanted to be president all his life and has been running for the office since 1988. So I don't think he's going to stop unless something seriously changes. And so if Michelle Obama were to step up either against Joe Biden or in the absence of Joe Biden's candidacy for reelection, what do you think that would do?
Well, I mean, the things that strike me is that this is a great candidacy on paper and in theory. She's a very appealing person. She was very appealing as First Lady. She appeals to a lot of the core constituencies in the Democratic Party. But it's also, she's never been elected to anything. And that makes a big difference. So she might be more of a sort of a paper tiger kind of a thing. We've had a whole history of these people looking great and checking off all these boxes that the political consultants come up with, and then they turn out to be bad candidates, or it's just not there for them. Like John Glenn, and there's an example from a swing state astronaut, national hero, completely collapsed as a candidate. And there's other examples, but I think that I'm just not persuaded that that she would have the fire to put herself through and her family through what she has seen happen to her husband, how difficult it was for him to deal with the criticism and the attacks and such. And the other thing I'd mention is that over the years, I've come to think that this is really important. I didn't used to think this, but the best candidates are the ones who enjoy doing it. And I don't think she would enjoy it. I think it's very clear to me that she'd be holding her nose the whole time, dealing with people she didn't like, trying to make compromises on things. Sometimes she'd have to go negative, which she's well known for saying, when they go low, we go high. Well, that's not the way it works sometimes. You got to sort of defend yourself. And there's a reason why every candidate goes negative at some point to win. One side note to this is that one thing that came out of the State of the Union for me is how much of a good time Joe Biden was having that night.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
He really was having a good time.
Yeah.
And I think, you just put like a Michelle Obama in that situation. Is there a comparable situation where she does part of the job or she the candidate and she's having a wonderful time? I haven't seen it. She has a wonderful time in other ways, which she's with her family, which she's with young African-American children, and so she's with her husband. But the blocking and tackling of politics, to me, that's she's got a long way to go before she looks like she's having a good time or having fun. And I thought Biden was having a good time. That told me something about his state of mind and what he wants to do with running.
Ken, I don't think I can improve on that. That was beautiful. That's a superb summary of that. I had been hearing very, very different things, but that resonates with me. I appreciate it. In terms of evaluating whether it would be in the Democrats' best interest to entertain Michelle Obama as a presidential candidate if she decided to do it, and whether the Republicans should fear it or welcome it. It's a fascinating combination. I have one final thing I want to ask about 2024, because as usual, the hour has flown by, and we just need to do this again and again and again. Someday we'll cover everything. And as usual, I get through about a third of my notes that I have to discuss with you. It looks to me in 2024 like the structural so let's review. In the Senate, one-third of the senators are up for election every 2 years because it's a six-year term. In the House of Representatives, everyone, all 435 members are up for election every 2 years. And in 24, the particular third of the Senate that's up for re-election strongly favors, or at least clearly favors, the Republicans. So it makes it look like the Republicans unless they screw up again and I suppose renominate Mehmet Oz, Doug Mastriano, Kerry Lake, Dan Bolduc, and the rest, they should win the Senate. The Republicans should win the Senate and retain the House, probably for those same reasons. But as for the White House, it looks like for the Democrats to win the White House, just from the Electoral College map, the Democrats have to win all three of Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Arizona. If they lose any one of those three, it doesn't look like, when you look at the electoral map, it doesn't look like they can possibly mathematically win the White House, unless, again, something crazy happens and, Florida and Arkansas and Mississippi all turn blue. I mean, it's something very unlikely. but it looks like the Democrats have to win Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Arizona. Do you see it the same way? And if so, do you see it as being a structural advantage for the Republicans that it's going to be difficult for the Democrats to overcome?
Yeah, I agree with all that. But the other part of it that I think is a very important factor to consider is, this campaign for the Senate, the Democrats are at a tremendous disadvantage. They have many more seats up. You'd think the Republicans would learn lessons from the last time and not, nominate two extreme people and so on. But at the same time, it's very possible that the House would flip back to the Democrats again. Just those four or five New York suburban seats, if they flip, then the Democrats are back in control.
That's true.
But as far as the Senate goes, I think the other part of it is that, The Republicans in Congress, in the House and Senate, have to be very careful not to overreach. If they do that, too many investigations, too much persecution of the president, that the Democrats will say, too many, you're getting one very extreme proposal after another. Lauren Boebert, the congresswoman from Colorado, is wants to do away with the entire Department of Education now. Now, that's not going to go anywhere, but it's going to create the impression that these people, once they have power, will inevitably go too far. And that gets back to what we talked about earlier. If the country, if that 80% of the country is not looking to for the polarization anymore, that's exactly the kind of dynamic that would turn them against the Republicans the next time. So I think that's a big factor. And I see a lot of signs that the Republicans are not going to learn that lesson. They've got, especially in the House, they're going to push and push and push for this more extreme agenda, which is not going to do them any favors with the General Electric in the middle. And there might be enough senators to go along with that to please their base in primaries that will work against them, too. So I think that's the other big factor for me.
Republicans snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Yes. That's right. It's
Ken Walsh. Exactly. I want to say thank you so much for being with me today. This is always a joy. I always learn something. I come away and I think about our conversation for days and days afterwards. I'd love to do this with you again. I think probably later this year, as we get closer and we figure out who's finally actually going to be running for president. We should know that within about 6 months. Would you like to join me again?
I'd love to. Let's plan on it.
That is what we will do. Kenneth Walsh, I want to say thank you again for being with me here today on TalkRadio1.com.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Kenneth T. Walsh. You can buy his book right here, right now, his latest book on the TalkRadio1.com website. It's called Presidential Leadership in Crisis, Defining Moments of the Modern Presidents from Franklin Roosevelt to Donald Trump. Now, when you look at this book, it will be exactly what it says on the title. It'll talk about presidential leadership in crisis. I found so much more in this book in terms of life planning and life decisions, personal leadership in my own life when I face a crisis and in the lives of others. This is a book that resonates not just in politics, but in actually talking about how to live life. Presidential Leadership in Crisis. Click on the book, buy it, read it. I'd love to hear your comments on it. I think you'll thoroughly enjoy it. Very well written, easy to read, but compelling all the way through. So my thanks to Ken Walsh for joining me. We'll do this again later this year, before the end of the year, so we can figure out where we are with what's happening in politics at that point. My next show will be 2 weeks from today. My guest is going to be Melanie Mason. Melanie is a national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, a journalist. She's well-established for over a decade, and she's gaining attention for her coverage of issues across the country. So Melanie Mason going to be with me 2 weeks from today. That is Saturday, March 4, 2023, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Ladies and gentlemen, please use our Amazon, eBay, and PayPal links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com to keep the podcasts available to you at no cost. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. And you need to say O-N-E. It works just that way for email. It's steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you for so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spear. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.